Arkansas's success in sports, well known. The 1964 football championship, the 94 March Madness run, trophy after trophy for the U of A track program, and then pro stars like Dizzy Dean, Torrey Hunter, and renowned jockey Pat Day. But as is the case with history, many intriguing stories fade from the popular memory or may not have ever been widely known at all. Evan Damorell collects many examples of such stories in his just-published book, African American Athletes in Arkansas, Muhammad Ali's Tour, Black Razorbacks, and Other Forgotten Stories. He's been on our program before discussing some of the subjects that are included in the new book, but not nearly all of them. He writes of the barnstorming baseball teams of Negro League baseball stars like Satchel Paige coming to Fort Smith to play a local team of African American players.
It's just amazing the amount of talent that would come down to Fort Smith and just essentially play for the love of the game. I mean, I'm sure they made a little money playing in front of the crowds at that time, but it wasn't anything like the money they could have made going to a bigger city.
Right. And it was often, you ask in the interview that you include in the book, you asked George McGill, I mean, do you remember hearing that any white teams would play black teams mm-hmm. or there would be mixed teams? He said, no, it was pretty much African-American teams playing African-American teams.
Pretty much African-American teams, for the most part, yes. And also, importantly, there was no interracial teams.
Right.
Blacks and whites right. on the same team. However, he does bring up a story I'd never heard before or seen recorded, and that was in the early 40s, maybe late 1930s. George's doesn't remember exactly, but he was saying his father at that time went up with this group of ball players to play a team, all-white team out of Fayetteville. And so they go up to Fayetteville, and they end up playing a fun game. But interestingly, one of the farmers up here in Fayetteville goes to George's dad and I think he's drunk at this point, but he's telling him
the farmer,
yes, and he says, you boys better win because we've bet on you, and if you win, we're going to give you all the moonshine you can handle. So they actually win. George's father's team wins the game, and they don't have a clear practice for the next week.
I love when you're talking to him because it's sort of this dichotomy. On one hand, it's sad because sports involving African American mm-hmm. athletes before a certain era were not as recorded mm-hmm. as the games with the white players. Mm-hmm. Just didn't have the mainstream press or whatever. So you lose some details. On the other hand, I love the idea of legend. Mm-hmm. And when you ask George McGill, so did your dad's team win? I love because you've got it verbatim.
Yeah.
Yes, they did. Well, I don't know if they did. Uh-huh. You know, I was told they uh-huh. did. There was even a bit of doubt in his mind. Did they really beat Satchel Paige uh-huh. and these guys? And the legend is his father picked a runner off first.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Which I love the fact Satchel. That there's something about me that loves not knowing for sure. Whether that was the ending, because that's a great ending.
That's true. I mean, we are that's a very optimistic way to look at it.
Yeah,
in that way of looking at it, we're almost in a golden age of – if we can get these stories while we can, not only from the old timers who are there living, but sometimes just their younger siblings or their sons or daughters, they too can be interviewed and recorded. And that in itself is valuable.
Did you feel an urgency with this book, trying to get some of the stories that took place decades ago?
Oh, no question. I mean, that's a main reason I decided to self-publish this book. Is I knew the faster I got it out. And by fast, I meant like a year.
Yeah.
Then the better for trying to get word out about this mission and hopefully building on it and seeing if we can't take this to, you know, into a bigger sphere. But, I mean, there were, a couple University of Arkansas Press was interested and Butler Center was interested in this idea, but it would have taken much longer.
The basketball team in Little Rock, the Jesters?
The Hilarious Jesters.
The Hilarious Jesters.
Yes.
Tell me about them.
So Hilarious Jesters is a frankly, it was the name itself kind of like opened up. Who were these guys? I ran across mention of them in Untold Stories, a Democrat Gazette anthology from about 14 years ago. But they were, it appears, the first integrated adult basketball team in Central Arkansas, potentially the state. I'm not sure, but I thought it was an interesting story because there's two protagonists here. There's a guy named Chester Lane, who is the original founder and organizer of the team. He's African-American of Little Rock. Then there's a guy named Dave McPherson, a white guy who had played basketball while in the Army in France and played in interracial teams in the 50s. So even though growing up he went to what is now Little Rock Central High and it was segregated, he had no problem playing against blacks in part because of that experience in France. So in the late 1950s, they just kind of randomly happened to meet each other on a court in downtown Little Rock, shooting around. They just start playing one-on-one. And they from that, they develop a bond, and they start kind of conscripting some of their friends, other high-level players. There's one guy, a white player who, Wayne Yates, who from North Little Rock, who'd go on to play for the Los Angeles Lakers. He'd come down and kind of scrimmage with them at Philander Smith College. Geese Osby, you know, was a guy who would scrimmage. They played against Eddie Miles mm-hmm. at the time, so it's very high level in Division One future pro type players. And they took some of these guys. I would say the team ended up being about one third white, two thirds black, kind of different members year to year. But through the early 1960s, they would play not only in Little Rock, but they would play in like places like Conway. Mm-hmm. Mostly all white crowds, or Searcy, Northeast Arkansas, all white crowds. And then they go down south, southeast, they'd go to like Altimer or England or Pine Bluff, and they would play against mostly black crowds,
right?
In front of mostly black crowds. And so I thought it was an interesting story because you kind of got a sense of there were some so-called white pioneers here. I mean, white guys who broke racial barriers in a way by going and playing on majority black teams in front of majority black crowds, and they got rousing too. So I think the ball bounced both ways sometimes when it came to integration.
We've highlighted some of the stories of whites and blacks playing together in front of crowds that might not expect that. Unfortunately, there are more stories about black athletes from Arkansas, and the stories are about being unable to play where they should have been able to play, and having to really sacrifice a lot to point out the inequities. I think mm-hmm. of some of the we've talked about in an earlier conversation mm-hmm. on this program, but some of the players who had to protest and perhaps lose careers mm-hmm. to try to advance it for the people who had come behind them.
Right. Yeah, like a guy like Ivy Moore,
yeah.
Pine Bluff native, who played for the Wyoming Cowboys in the late 1960s. At the time, Wyoming actually was on the cusp of being a kind of a mid-major powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
They were a trending program, and they were like, I think they were ranked in the top 15 the year Ivy Moore was junior, and he had a group of really strong African-American players on that Cowboys team. A few of them went on to play in the NFL. And in the middle of that season, they decide, you know, we're going to take a stand. We're going to take a stand against BYU, because BYU at the time did not allow blacks to become ministers in their church. And that had kind of sparked strikes within athletic programs in places like on the West Coast, in Stanford and those kind of places. And that had spread. The Wyoming football players kind of took up the cause, and they decided, we're going to sit out against essentially, we're going to make a stand and do it against in the BYU team. The coach of the Wyoming Cowboys at the time did not support the player, unlike the coach of the Missouri Tigers.
Just a couple of years ago,
he did support their protests. This coach did not in 1969. They never play another game for the Cowboys program, and except for like a brief surge in the 80s, the Wyoming football really has never recovered thoroughly from that event. These kind of guys just need to be more well known. Eddie Boone's another one.
Yeah,
Houston Nutt's quarterback coach, who before he was Houston Nutt's quarterback coach at Little Rock Central, he was the head coach at Menifee in basketball, and he ends up kind of breaking racial barriers by taking an all black team and playing against all white competition as the first Arkansas Activity Association black coach, essentially.
I also think that there are a lot of small towns, not just in Arkansas, but around the country, have their hometown legends.
Mm-hmm.
Guys that maybe didn't go on to stellar careers in college, let alone pros, but were great and helped win a state championship or a great run in a small town. There are some of the African-American prep players in Arkansas that maybe just don't achieve that sort of legendary status because of segregation. You know, that played at schools and aren't as remembered or as revered as some of their white counterparts.
Well, yeah, look at Bruce Fullerton.
Yeah.
I think he would be a primary example. Bruce Fullerton kind of was you know, an all-American running back for Little Rock Central High during the integration crisis in that era, in 1957. At the same time, that Central High team was the number one team in the nation, you know, ranked by some polls. So extremely good team. Fullerton ends up going to play for the Razorbacks a little bit. It doesn't really work out up here, and he never really achieves anything like he did in high school. But to this day, his legend endures in many parts of the state. And in part, that's just because you have so many records and memoirs and yearbooks that just praise him to high end, you know? Not just, it's deserved.
Right.
But at the same time, there's just so many books, so many yearbooks, so many records. It's not the same thing with most of these African Americans, with an exception of Dunbar High School.
Mm-hmm.
Dunbar High School is a little different game in Little Rock in that it did have, it was very well funded, very well supported. It had a lot of yearbooks coming out of it. They even have a museum in Little Rock Central High. There you can kind of find books about Dunbar. Dunbar itself at the junior high now has a kind of an archive within it. That's an exception. Other than that school, there's not as much.
When you think of this era now, in the days of Torrey Hunter, the Pine Bluff high school kid who went on to a stellar major league career, Sidney Moncrief, really, I would say, is still arguably the most famous Razorback basketball player in history.
He has to be right there with a guy like Corliss.
Corliss won the national champ. Yeah.
So Sidney, arguably, maybe a bigger name because of his NBA success.
Right. I mean, you know, all-star, defensive player of the year.
2 year times.
Right. It's hard to imagine with those figures. And I mentioned Moncrief and Hunter because they were Arkansas-born, not just Arkansas Razorbacks, but
born
natives of Arkansas. Yeah. It's hard to imagine that there was a time, not incredibly long ago, when we just, as a state, didn't want to include African-American athletes as part of our tapestry.
It's not to be taken for granted, the fact that the Razorback brand has become such a unifying force, as we can see with this outpouring of emotion for Frank Broyles. He was a big part of the reason it's unifying force. However, it is interesting to know that while you had guys like Eddie Miles, who were Razorback fans in the 50s, you had these African-American fans that we've talked about in the past in the 40s in Fayetteville, there were many African-Americans. This is just kind of anecdotally, and also through the memoir of Elin Harris, who in pre-integration in the 60s and 50s, they were not Razorback fans. These are Arkansas natives, not Razorback fans. They're getting angry at their relatives when they're listening to the Razorback games on the radio.
Because they're segregated teams.
Exactly. It reminds them of what they don't have and the injustice of society. Of course, that changes when guys like Sidney come on the scene, John Richardson, Muskie Harris, Dirt Winston. You know, you go on and on with these guys in the late 60s and 1970s. And today, it's hard to imagine, you know, if you're black, you don't like the Razorbacks because of a race issue. I mean, it's majority African-American now in basketball.
And yet, Evan, when someone 50 years from now writes the update, it's hard to imagine they will not be writing about the women's basketball season that was just completed because race became, or racial issues, social issues became part of that. Mm-hmm. And it always wasn't, I don't think it will be remembered necessarily always as a banner time in public discourse.
No.
Because when some of the players, I think all the players who took a knee might have been African American. There were some ugly things said. So work to be done?
Work to be done, and also changing of dynamic. I mean, what guys like Ivy Moore went through was not easy in 1969. But their phones weren't blowing up with hate messages.
They didn't have Twitter messages.
They didn't have Twitter messages, and they didn't have phones in their pockets. And so I think I would say that the dynamic of what a player taking a stand today, whether you agree with the stand or not, it does take courage to take that stand and then live with the repercussions, because a lot of these women, their lives have been changed.
Evan De Morrell is the author of the just-published book, African American Athletes in Arkansas, Muhammad Ali's Tour, Black Razorbacks, and Other Forgotten Stories. He'll sign books Saturday afternoon from 4 until 6:30 and at the Fayetteville Barnes & Noble location a week from Saturday. He'll be at Nightbird Books in downtown Fayetteville September 7th and later at the Clinton School of Public Affairs in Little Rock. You can find out much more about the book at heritageofsports.com. And we'll hear more from the conversation Sunday morning on Weekend Ozarks at Large at 9 o'clock on 91.3 KUAF.